When word got out that he was recruiting a flying column of elite cavalry, Merrin was besieged by volunteers. He chose as his captains three hardy veterans, Hilto Bar Hilto, Shabako and Tonka. None had ridden and fought with him during the Civil War. They were too young for that, but their fathers had, and their grandfathers had all been companions of the Red Road. "The warrior blood breeds true," Merrin explained to Taita. His fourth choice was Habari, whom he had come to like and trust. He offered him the command of one of his four platoons. He mustered all four captains, confirmed their selection, and questioned them closely. "Have you a wife or a woman? We travel light. There will be no place with us for camp followers." Traditionally, Egyptian armies travelled with their women. "I have a wife," Habari said, "but I'll be pleased to escape from her scolding for 5 years or 10, even longer if you require it, Colonel." The other three agreed with this sensible view. "Colonel, if we are to live off the land, then we will take our women where we find them," said Hilto Bar Hilto, the son of old Hilto, now long dead. He had been the best of 10,000, and had worn the gold of praise at his throat, awarded to him by Pharaoh after the Battle of Ishmaelia, when they had overthrown the false Pharaoh. "Spoken like a true legionary," Merrin laughed. He delegated to the chosen four the selection of the troopers to fill their platoons. Within less than 10 days they had assembled 100 of the finest warriors in the entire Egyptian army. Each man was equipped, armed, and sent to the remount station to pick out 2 chargers and a pack mule. As Pharaoh had commanded, they were ready to march from Thebes on the night of the new moon. 2 days before the departure, Taita crossed the river and rode to the palace of Memnon to take his leave of Queen Mintaka. He found her thinner, wan, and cast down. The reason for this, she confided to him within the first few minutes of their meeting. "Oh, Tata, dear Tata, the most dreadful thing has transpired. Soe has vanished. He has gone without taking leave of me. He disappeared 3 days after you saw him in my audience chamber." Taita was not surprised. That had been the day of Demeter's gruesome death. "I have sent messengers to find him in every possible place. Taita, I know you will be as distressed as I am. You knew and admired him. We both saw in him the salvation of Egypt. Can you not use your special powers to find him for me and bring him back to me? Now that he is gone, I will never see my dead babies again. Egypt and Nefer will remain in perpetual agony. The Nile will never flow." Taita did his best to console her. He could see that her health was deteriorating, and her proud spirit was on the point of breaking under the weight of her despair. He cursed Eos and her works, while he did all in his power to calm Mintaka and give her hope. "Merrin and I are setting out on an expedition beyond the southern borders. I will make it my first duty to search for you, and make inquiry for Soe at every point along our way. In the meantime, I divine that he is alive and unharmed. Unexpected circumstances and events forced him to depart hurriedly, without taking leave of your majesty. However, he intends to return to Thebes at the first opportunity to continue his mission in the name of the new nameless goddess." All of which was reasonable assumptions, Taita told himself. "Now I must bid you farewell. I shall hold you always in my thoughts and my dutiful love." The Nile was no longer navigable, so they took the wagon road south along the bank of the dying river. Pharaoh rode the first mile at Taita's side, belaboring him with commands and instructions. Before he turned back, he addressed the troopers of the column in an exhortation and rallying call. "I expect each of you to do his duty," he ended, and embraced Taita in front of them. As he rode away, they cheered him out of sight. Taita had planned the stages of the journey to bring them each evening to one of the many temples situated along the banks of the Nile in the Upper Kingdom. At each his reputation had preceded him. The high priest came out to offer him and his men shelter. Their welcome was sincere because Merrin carried the king's hawk seal, which allowed him to draw additional food from the quartermasters of the military forts that guarded each town. The priest expected their own meagre rations to be augmented by this windfall. Each evening, after a frugal meal in the refectory, Taita retired to the inner sanctuary of the temple. Devotions and prayers had been said in these precincts for hundreds or even thousands of years. The passion of the worshippers had built spiritual fortifications that even Eos would have the greatest difficulty in penetrating. For a while he would be protected from her overlooking. He could appeal to his own gods without fear of intervention by evil wraiths sent by the witch to deceive him. He prayed to the god to whom each temple was dedicated, for strength and guidance in his looming conflict with the witch. In the calm and serenity of each surroundings, he could meditate and marshal his physical and spiritual strength. The temples were the center of each community, and the repositories of learning. Although many of the priests were dull creatures, some were erudite and educated, aware of all that was happening in their gnomes and in tune with the mood of their flock. They were a reliable source of information and intelligence. Taita spent hours conferring with them, interrogating them keenly. One question he put to them all. "Have you heard of strangers moving covertly among your people, preaching a new religion?" Each one replied that they had. "They preach that the old gods are failing, that they are no longer able to protect this very Egypt. They preach of a new goddess who will descend among us and lift the curse from the river and the land. When she comes, she will bid the plague cease, and Mother Nile once more to flood and deliver Egypt her bounty. They tell the people that Pharaoh and his family are secret adherents of the new goddess, that soon Nefertiti will renounce the old gods and declare his allegiance to her." Then, worried, they demanded, "Tell us, great Magus, is this true? Will Pharaoh declare for the alien goddess?" "Before that happens, the stars will fall from the sky like raindrops. Pharaoh is devoted to Horus, heart and soul," he assured them. "But tell me, do the people hearken to these charlatans?" "They are only human. Their children are starving, and they are in the depths of despair. They will follow anyone who offers them surcease from their misery." "Have you met any of these preachers?" None had. "They are secretive and elusive," said one. "Although I have sent messengers to them, inviting them to explain their beliefs to me, none has come forward." "Have you learnt the names of any?" "It seems they all use the same name." "Is it Soe?" Taita asked. "Yes, Magus. That is the name they use. Perhaps it is a title rather than a name." "Are they Egyptians or foreigners? Do they speak our language as though born to it?" "I have heard that they do, and that they claim to be of our blood." The man he was conversing with on this occasion was Sanepi, the high priest of the temple of Qum, in Unyet, in the third nome of Upper Egypt. When Taita had heard all he had to offer on this matter, he moved on to more mundane topics. "As an adept of the natural laws, have you tried to find some way in which to render the red waters of the river fit for human use?" The urbane and devout man was appalled at the suggestion. "The river is cursed. No one dare bathe in it, let alone drink it. The kine that do so waste away and die within days. The river has become the abode of gigantic carrion-eating toads, such as have never been seen before in Egypt or in any other land. They defend the stinking pools ferociously and attack anyone who approaches. I would rather die of thirst than drink that poison," Sanepi replied, his features twisted in an expression of disgust. "Even the temple novices believe, as I do, that the river has been desecrated by some malevolent god." So it was that Taita took it upon himself to conduct a series of experiments to ascertain the true nature of the red tide, and to find some method of purifying the Nile waters. Meryn was pushing the column southwards at a punishing pace, and he knew that unless he could find some means of augmenting their water supply, the horses would soon die of thirst. Pharaoh's newly dug wells were situated at long intervals, and their yield was not nearly sufficient for the needs of 300 hard-driven horses. This was the easiest stage of the journey. Above the white water of the first cataract, the river road ran thousands of leagues through hard, forbidding deserts, where there were no wells. It rained there once in 100 years, and was the haunt of scorpions and wild animals, such as the oryx, which could survive without surface water in the domain of the tyrannical sun. Unless he could find some reliable source of water, the expedition would perish in those scorching wastes, never to reach the confluence of the Nile, let alone its source. At every overnight camp, Taita spent hours on his experiments, aided by four of Merin's youngest troopers, who had volunteered to assist him. They were honoured to work side by side with the mighty Magus. It was a tale they would tell their grandchildren. When he presided over them, they had no fear of demons and curses, for all had a blind faith in Taita's ability to protect them. They laboured night after night without complaint, but even the Magus's genius could find no way to sweeten the stinking waters. 17 days after they had set out from Karnak, they reached the large temple complex dedicated to the goddess Hathor on the riverbank at Kumombo. The High Priestess extended the usual warm welcome to the celebrated Magus. As soon as Taita had seen his helpers put copper pots upon the fires to boil the Nile water, he left them to it and went to the inner sanctuary of the temple. No sooner had he entered it than he became aware of a benevolent influence. He went to the image of the cow goddess and sat cross-legged before it. Since Demeter had warned him that the images of Lostris he was receiving were almost certainly untrustworthy, conjured by the witch to deceive and confuse him, he had not dared to invoke her presence. However, in this place he felt he had the protection of Hathor, one of the most powerful goddesses in the pantheon. A patroness of all women, surely she would shield Lostris in her sanctuary. He prepared himself mentally by reciting aloud 3 times the rites of approach to a deity, then opened his inner eye and waited quietly in the shadowy silences. Gradually the silence was broken by his own pulse beating in his ears, the harbinger of a spiritual presence drawing near to him. It grew stronger, and he waited for the sensation of cold to envelop him, prepared to break off the contact at the first touch of frost in the air. The sanctuary remained quiet and pleasantly warm. His sense of security and peace increased as he drifted towards sleep. He closed his eyes and beheld a vision of limpid water, then heard a sweet childlike voice call his name. "Taita, I am coming to you." He saw something flash in the depths of the water and thought a silver fish was rising to the surface. Then he saw that he had been mistaken. It was the slim white body of a child swimming towards him. A head broke the surface, and he saw that she was a girl of about 12. Her long, sodden hair streamed down over her face and tiny breasts in a golden veil. "I heard your call." The laughter was a happy sound, and he laughed in sympathy. The child swam towards him, reached a white sandbank just below the surface, and stood up. She was a girl, although her hips had not yet taken on feminine curves, and the outline of her ribs was all that adorned her torso. There was a tiny hairless crease between her thighs. "Who are you?" he asked. With a toss of her head, she threw back her hair to reveal her face. His heart swelled until it hampered his breathing. It was Lostris. "Fie on you that you do not know me, for I am Fen," she said. The name meant moonfish. "I knew you all along," Taita told her. "You are exactly as you were when first I met you. I could never forget your eyes. They were then and still are the greenest and prettiest in all Egypt." "You lie, Taita. You did not recognize me?" She stuck out a pointed pink tongue. "I taught you not to do that." "Then you did not teach me very well." "Fen was your baby name," he reminded her. "When you showed your first red moon, the priests changed it to your woman's name." "Daughter of the Waters," she grimaced at him. "I never liked it. Lostris sounds so silly and stuffy. I much prefer Fen." "Then Fen you shall be," he told her. "I will be waiting for you," she promised. "I came with a gift for you, but now I must go back. They are calling me." She dived gracefully deep under the surface, her arms along her flanks, kicking with her slim legs to drive herself deeper. Her hair billowed behind her like a golden flag. "Come back," he called after her. "You must tell me where you will wait for me." But she was gone, and only a faint echo of laughter floated back to him. When he woke, he knew it was late, for the temple lamps were guttering. He felt refreshed and exhilarated. He became aware that he was clutching something in his right hand. He opened his fist carefully and saw that he held a handful of white powder. He wondered if this was Fenn's gift. He lifted it to his nose and sniffed it cautiously. "Lime!" he exclaimed. Every village along the river had a primitive kiln in which the peasants burned lumps of limestone to this powder. They painted the walls of their huts and granaries with it. The white coating reflected the sun's rays and kept the interiors cooler. He was about to throw it away, but restrained himself. The gift of a goddess should be treated with respect. He smiled at his folly. He folded and knotted the handful of lime into the hem of his tunic and went out. Meryn was waiting for him at the doors to the sanctuary. "Your men have prepared the river water for you, but they have waited long for you to come to them. They are tired from the journey and need to sleep." There was a gentle rebuke in Meryn's tone. He took care of his own men. "I hope that you do not plan to stay up all night over your stinking water pots. I will come to fetch you before midnight, for I will not allow it." Taita ignored the threat and asked, "Does Shofar have to hand the potions I prepared to treat the waters?" Meryn laughed. "As he remarked, they stink worse than the red waters." He led Taita to where the four pots bubbled and steamed. His helpers, who had been squatting around the fires, scrambled to their feet, thrust long poles through the handles of the pots, and lifted them off the flames. Taita waited for the water to cool sufficiently, then went along the row of pots, adding his potions to them. Shofar stirred each one with a wooden paddle. As he was about to treat the final pot, Taita paused. "The gift of Fenn," he murmured, and untied the knot in the hem of his tunic. He poured the lime into the last pot. For good measure, he made a pass with the golden periapt of Lostris over the mixture and intoned a word of power. "Inkubi!" The four helpers exchanged an awed glass. "Leave the pots to cool until morning," Taita ordered, "and go to your rest. You have done well. I thank you." The minute Taita stretched out on his sleeping mat, he fell into a death-like slumber, untroubled by dreams or even Meryn's snores. At dawn when they awoke, Shofar was at the door with a huge grin on his face. "Come swiftly, mighty Magus. We have something for your comfort." They hurried to the pots beside the cold ashes of last night's fires. Herbari and the other captain stood to attention at the head of their troopers, all drawn up in review order. They beat their sword scabbards against their shields and cheered as though Taita were a victorious general taking possession of the battleground. "Quiet!" Taita groused. "You will split my skull!" But they cheered him all the louder. The first three pots were filled with a nauseating black stew. But the water in the fourth was clear. He scooped out a handful and tasted it gingerly. It was not sweet, but redolent with the earthy flavour that had sustained them all since childhood, the familiar taste of Nile mud. From then on, at each overnight camp, they boiled and limed the pots of river water. And in the mornings, before they set out, they filled the water skins. No longer weakened by thirst, the horses recovered and the pace of the march quickened. 9 days later, they reached Aswan. Ahead lay the first of the six great cataracts. They were formidable obstacles for boats, but horses could take the caravan road around them. In the town of Aswan, Meryn rested the horses and men for 3 days and replenished their grain bags at the royal granary. He allowed the troopers to fortify themselves against the rigours of the next long leg of the journey by recourse to the joy houses along the waterfront. Conscious of his new rank and responsibility, he himself greeted the blandishments and bold-eyed invitations of the local beauties with feigned indifference. The pool below the first cataract had shriveled to a puddle, so Taita had no need of a boatman to row him to the tiny rock island on which stood the great temple of Isis. Its walls were chiselled with gigantic images of the goddess, her husband Osiris, and Horus, her son. Windsmoke carried Taita across to it, her hooves ringing on the rocky riverbed. All of the priests were assembled to greet him, and he spent the next 3 days with them. They had little news for him of conditions in Nubia to the south. In the good times when the flood of the Nile had been reliable, strong and true, there had been a large fleet of trading vessels plying the river up to Kibui, at the confluence of the two Niles. They returned with ivory, the dried meat and skins of wild animals, baulks of timber, bars of copper, and gold nuggets from the mines along the Atbara River, the principal tributary of the Nile. Now that the flood had failed and the waters that remained in the pools along the way had turned to blood, few travellers braved the dangerous road through the deserts on foot or horseback. The priests warned that the southern road and the hills along its way had become the home of criminals and outcasts. Once again he inquired after the preachers of the false goddess. They told him that it was rumoured Soe prophets had appeared from the wastes and made their way northwards towards Karnak and the Delta, but none had had contact with them. When night fell, Taita retired to the inner sanctuary of the mother goddess Isis, and under her protection felt at ease to meditate and pray. Although he invoked his patron goddess, he received no direct response from her during the first two nights of his vigil. Nevertheless, he felt stronger and better prepared to face the challenges that lay ahead on the road to Kabui and in the uncharted lands and swamps beyond. His inevitable confrontation with Eos seemed less daunting. His strengthened body and resolve might have been the result of hard riding in the company of young troopers and officers and the spiritual disciplines he had observed since leaving Thebes, but it gave him pleasure to think that the close proximity of the goddess Lostris, or Fen, as she now chose to be known, had armed him for the struggle. On the last morning, as the first light of dawn roused him, he asked again for Isis's blessing and protection, and for those of any other gods who might be near. As he was about to leave the sanctuary, he cast a last glance at the statue of Isis, which was hewn from a monolith of red granite. It towered to the roof, and the head was shrouded in shadow, the stone eyes staring ahead implacably. He stooped to pick up his staff from beside the rug and plaited papyrus on which he had passed the night. Before he could straighten, the pulse started to beat softly in his ears, but he experienced no chill on his naked upper body. He looked up to see that the statue was gazing down at him. The eyes had come alive and glowed a luminous green. They were Fen's eyes, and their expression was as gentle as that of a mother watching an infant asleep at her breast. "Fen," he whispered. "Lostris, are you here?" The echo of her laughter came from the stone vaulting high above his head, but he could see only the dark shape of bats flitting back to their roosts. His eyes switched back to the statue. The stone head was alive now, and it was Fen's. "Remember, I am waiting for you," she whispered. "Where will I find you? Tell me where to look," he begged. "Where else would you search for a moonfish?" she teased him. "You will find me hiding among the other fishes." "But where are the fishes?" he pleaded. Already her living features were hardening into stone and the brilliant eyes dulling. "Where?" he cried. "When?" "Beware the prophet of darkness. He carries a knife. He also waits for you," she whispered sadly. "Now I must go. She will not let me stay longer." "Who will not let you stay? Isis or another?" To utter the name of the witch in this holy place would be sacrilege, but the statue's lips had frozen. Hands tugged at his upper arm. He started and looked around, expecting another apparition to materialize, but he saw only the anxious face of the high priest, who said, "Magus, what ails you? Why do you cry out?" "It was a dream. Just a foolish dream." "Dreams are never foolish. You of all people should know that. They are warnings and messages from the gods." He took his leave of the holy men and went out to the stables. Windsmoke ran to meet him, kicking up her heels playfully, a bunch of hay stalks dangling from the corner of her mouth. "They have been spoiling you, you fat old strumpet. Look at you now, cavorting like a foal, you with your big belly," Taita scolded her lovingly. During their sojourn at Karnak, a careless groom had let one of Pharaoh's favourite stallions reach her. Now she quietened and stood still to let him mount, then carried him to where Meron's troopers were breaking camp. When the column was ready, the men standing by their horses' heads with the spare mounts and the pack mules on lead reins, Meron went down the ranks checking weapons and equipment, making certain that each man had his copper water pot and a bag of lime strapped to the back of the mule. "Mount!" he roared from the head of the column. Move out! Walk! Trot! A train of weeping women followed them to the foot of the hills, where they fell back, unable to keep up with the pace that Merrin set. Bitter the parting, but sweet the memories, Hilto Bar Hilto remarked, and his platoon chuckled. Nay, Hilto, Merrin called from the head of the column, the sweeter the flesh, the sweeter the memories. They roared with laughter and drummed on the shields with their scabbards. They laugh now, Taita said dryly, but let us see if they still laugh in the furnace of the desert. They looked down into the gorge of the cataract. There was no rush of angry waters. The vicious rocks, which were usually a hazard to shipping, were now exposed and dry, black as the backs of a herd of wild buffalo. At the top end, on a bluff overlooking the gorge, stood a tall granite obelisk. While the men watered their steeds and the mules, Taita and Merrin climbed the cliff to the monument and stood at its foot. Taita read aloud the inscription. I, Queen Lostris, regent of Egypt, and widow of Pharaoh Mamoz, eighth of that name, mother of the crown prince Memnon, who shall rule the two kingdoms after me, have ordained the raising of this monument. This is the mark and covenant of my vow to the people of this very Egypt, that I shall return to them from the wilderness whence I have been driven by the barbarian. This stone was placed here in the first year of my rule, the 900th after the building of the great pyramid of Pharaoh Cheops. Let this stone stand immovable as the pyramid until I make good my promise to return. As the memories flooded back, Taita's eyes filled with tears. He remembered her on the day that they had raised the obelisk. Lostris had been 20, proud in her royalty and womanly glory. It was on this spot that Queen Lostris placed the gold of praise upon my shoulders, he told Merrin. It was heavy, but less precious to me than her favour. They went down to the horses and rode on. The desert enveloped them like the flames of a mighty bonfire. They could not ride during the day, so they boiled and limed the river water, then lay in any shade they could find, panting like hard-run hounds. When the sun touched the western horizon, they rode on through the night. In places, the gaunt cliffs crowded the river bank so closely that they could only ride in single file along the narrow track. They passed tumble-down huts that had once given shelter to travellers who had gone before them. But they were deserted. They found no fresh sign of any human presence until the 10th day after they had left Aswan, when they came across another cluster of abandoned huts beside what had been a deep pool. One had been recently occupied. The ashes on the hearth were still fresh and crisp. As soon as Taita entered it, he sensed the faint but unmistakable taint of the witch. As his eyes adjusted to the shadows, he made out writing in hieratic script that had been scratched on the wall with a stick of charcoal. Eos is great. Eos cometh. Not long ago, one of the witch's adherents had passed this way. His footprints were still in the dust of the floor at the bottom of the wall where he had stood to write the exhortation. It was almost sunrise, and the heat of the day was coming swiftly upon them. Merrin ordered the column to make camp. Even the ruined huts would afford some shelter from the cruel sun. While this was happening, and before the heat became unbearable, Taita cast around for other traces of the Eos worshipper. In a patch of loose earth on the stony track that led south, he found hoofprints. By their set, he could tell that the horse must have carried a heavy load. The tracks were heading south towards Kibui. Taita called Merrin and asked, "How old are these tracks?" Merrin was an expert scout and tracker. "Impossible to be certain, Magus. More than 3 days, less than 10." "Then already the Eos worshipper is far ahead of us."